Thank you so much for all of your presence here tonight. I'm always super grateful and happy to give a talk. And today or tonight, we're going to be continuing to explore mindfulness of the hindrances, with the hindrance today being aversion. And we're going to be exploring it with some depth and some friendliness. So last week, Susan gave a really thoughtful and relatable talk on the hindrance of sense desire, the craving and clinging that arises towards pleasant feelings or sensations. And her overview of craving sets this juxtaposing stage for the hindrance of aversion, which is characterized by this felt sense of resistance towards unpleasant feelings and sensations. So, if the hindrance of craving is felt as an urge or compulsion to move towards something that seems pleasurable, then the hindrance of aversion is felt as an urge or compulsion to move away from something that would seem or something that is feeling unpleasant. So both craving and aversion are important hindrances because they comprise two out of the three poisons, which the Buddha basically said are the core causes of human suffering, along with the third poison of ignorance. And if we were to just take a stroll back to the First Noble Truth to kind of set the stage, the First Noble Truth says that suffering is an inherent part of life. And if this forms the bedrock of the Four Noble Truths, then we can get a sense as to how this foundation, this truth that suffering is a part of life, would then sprout this hindrance of aversion, which in Pali is translated as vayapada. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. But in essence, if we can understand that aversion, this propensity to push away something that is unpleasant, something that is suffering, or how we might maybe characterize some form of pain as a form of suffering, then we might see how a hindrance like aversion would have this maybe natural proclivity to show up. So, aversion is a state of mind and body that shows up as contraction, resistance, pushing away. It's also colored by ill will, or maybe known otherwise as ill will. And the framing of ill will in particular, even if it may just be interchangeable with aversion, I think offers a nuance for understanding aversion as like a spectrum of flavors of being in a state of dislike, ranging from maybe mild dislike to like maybe rage or destructive hatred. And the spectrum of varying states of dislike shows up when we encounter some form of suffering or unpleasant feelings or sensations or situations. And if we were to maybe imagine a sequence for how this might show up, we might first imagine that there is something unpleasant that shows up. A feeling, a sensation, maybe a contraction in the body, and then arises aversion, this guest that enters the scene, and then aversion then creates or is embedded in a felt sense of resistance or contraction. So then the resistance and contraction that is embedded in aversion is then palpably felt in the body as its own form of contraction. Maybe muscles are tensing, teeth is grinding, maybe there's even some heat or frigidity that shows up in the body. And the contraction can even show up in the mind, where the otherwise spaciousness of awareness or the mind may narrow and constrict around the object of aversion. So there's first the unpleasant feeling, and then the aversion of contraction around the unpleasant feeling or sensation, and then there is that flavor of ill will, if we were to entertain it as this maybe nuanced version of it, which is this attitude of, I don't like this, I don't want this, or I hate this. And this then colors the whole experience. And this attitude of, I don't like this, I don't want this, I hate this, is the core essence of this hindrance of ill will or aversion. It's a state that, in and of itself, carries a contraction or unpleasantness. And if you were to even take a moment to experiment and think to yourself, just the phrase, I don't like this, or I don't want this, which you don't have to necessarily do it right now, but as, say, an invitation to experiment, you might find that just by thinking the thought, I don't like this. Even when you're feeling neutral, you may begin to feel a sense of contraction, even if it's subtle, but you may feel that contraction begin to emerge from just introducing intentionally aversion as a little bit of an experiment. And I think that this is an important observation, that aversion as the hindrance alone carries this contraction, especially if one is just feeling neutral, because then it can be noticed how it carries in and of itself not only contraction, but already this feeling tone of unpleasantness. And then we begin to see how aversion, as its own maybe component that emerges within the mind or in the body, will then amplify and prolong the unpleasantness that it is reacting to. Because if I'm already feeling unpleasant, and then aversion arises as this unpleasant reaction to the unpleasant feeling, then it may become clear how aversion has this inevitable effect of making unpleasant states feel even more unpleasant. So, as an example, if I have a stomach ache, which is already, typically an unpleasant experience, and, I'm having contractions like in my abdominal area, it's already overall unpleasant, and there are already contractions in the body. But these contractions aren't maybe the same as the contraction that is felt with aversion, because the contractions are the body just doing its thing. But it's when I'm having this unpleasant stomach ache that I then notice aversion has emerged and is then coloring or is maybe overlaying the unpleasant feeling and sensations with this unpleasant blanket of, I hate this, I don't like this, I want this to go away or to go away. I don't know about you, if I mean, I'm sure maybe everyone here has had a stomach ache before, but when I've had a stomach ache and I am reacting to it with a very prominent aversion, I feel more sick. And I think that that goes to show the compounding effect that aversion can have when there is some unpleasant feeling or sensation already occurring in the body. And so it's a bit ironic when you think about it, since the storyline often maybe underlying aversion is if I resist this pain or unpleasant feeling, I'll make it go away and therefore I'll feel better. How tends to be the opposite and it makes it end up feeling worse. So aversion can show up in that type of introverted way where we are reacting to something that is showing up in the body or simply just the feeling that we're having. But it can also take form in an extroverted way where one feels a resistance towards outer objects as well. And of course, I mean, this does show up inside as the contraction or an unpleasant feeling, but the idea is that aversion can be directed inward and it can also be directed outward. And if we were to maybe enter this realm of emotional language, we might ascribe aversion as most generally corresponding with anger or fear, although it is not limited to anger or fear. There's certainly, like disgust or jealousy, repulsion, things like that. But maybe as two umbrella emotions that we could focus on might be anger and fear. And traditionally speaking, the Satipatthana Sutta does state that feelings are either pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. So that I think is important to acknowledge. But we can also see how maybe some of these emotional labels that we do use, maybe in our day-to-day or in our relationships, such as anger and fear, would certainly fall under the umbrella of maybe unpleasant feelings. And it can be sometimes skillful to acknowledge and frame whatever we're feeling aversion to with this emotional language as I'm feeling frustrated that I have a stomach ache, or I'm feeling afraid that something might happen in the outside world as a means to practice this mindful investigation of the roots of certain stories with the intention to develop wisdom and an insight in the service of uprooting some of the seeds that tend to fuel certain stories that elicit aversion over and over again. Because certainly, I mean, if I have a stomach ache every once in a while and there's aversion that comes up there, it may be a pretty straightforward, say, acknowledgement that this aversion is coming up in a very specific and occasional situation. But oftentimes, we may notice that there are certain habitual triggers of aversion that are not exclusive to a one-off stomach ache, but we may find that we struggle with anxiety. And so there is maybe a natural sort of aversion that may come up on a very regular basis, or maybe we struggle with feeling really frustrated on a daily basis towards certain things inside or outside. And so the practice of mindful investigation when certain patterns do come up for a person on a regular basis can help to gain deeper insight into the seeds that may be embedded underneath those stories. So if we were to imagine, right, even taking the example of something like anxiety, I personally sometimes have a tendency to catastrophize. Maybe some of you have experienced catastrophizing too, this propensity to maybe like imagine the worst case scenario. I have a headache and it's like, oh my God, I need to go to the hospital, something's wrong, or something like that. And this is common, right, whenever maybe something unexpected happens, and maybe the nervous system is really predisposed to react with a lot of fear and alarm. but with it comes certain stories. And when maybe that is a pattern of the mind to catastrophize very frequently, it certainly would produce a lot of distress and suffering for a person. So I noticed that for my catastrophizing, there are a few underlying themes that bring up this type of aversion. Maybe it's a theme revolving around some ordeal happening in the future, or maybe a theme of being rejected by others or making a mistake, to name a few. But again and again, it's these types of stories that seem to pop up wearing different hats, but that all carry some degree of aversion. And if I practice this type of mindful investigation towards any one of these themes, I might find a seed or two which underlies the continuous sprouting of all these stories. So, if I take the example of catastrophizing about some ordeal that happens in the future, basically something that would be really big and scary and like really trying that I would have to go through. And I practice this non-judgmental curiosity in the moment that a particular story comes up, and I really question these layered assumptions, I might arrive at a core fear, which is that a huge challenge might come up and I would be helpless to face it. So, in other words, through this mindful investigation, I learn and I gain this insight that the fear is maybe less to do about whatever particular challenge my mind is concocting about the future, and more to do with an underlying assumption of it being an insurmountable challenge, an assumption that I would just be powerless and helpless and unable to work through it. And when I examine this seed for what it is, I'm able to see, perhaps with a little bit more clarity, that it's just not true. And it's not true because I might be able to look back and see that I've gone through hard things. So I can get through hard things in the future too. That I do possess the capability, that I wouldn't be helpless. And this does not mean that I therefore convince myself that there won't be challenges that arise, because then that would be just replacing this illusion seed with a different kind of illusion seed. But rather, it means that I could see the seed as not really having a leg to stand on, since I can recall concrete past experiences which were difficult and I made it through. So at this point, whatever story might come up about whatever ordeal, whatever hat it takes on, because I've gone through this mindful investigation and identified maybe the core seed of it being about a sense of powerlessness or the fear that I would be powerless, I could very easily maybe then inoculate that and correct maybe the misinformed or misguided belief that was there in the first place. We can see even a similar process with stories that may be revolving around anger. Maybe one notices that certain stories carry lots of shoulds, like this should be this way, this shouldn't be this way. That person should or shouldn't be that way. I should or shouldn't be this way. And it's these narratives of shoulds, if they do come up very frequently, that also carry this undertone of anger or judgment and therefore aversion. And this too can be traced back to certain seeds. For example, if we were to find ourselves judging maybe the qualities in a person, or we find that we're continuously feeling irritated by the same type of quality in various different people, over a long period of time, we might be able to gauge that there are at least two seeds here. One seed might be related to the fact that whatever quality that we seem to judge others for might mirror some similar quality that we judge ourselves for. So, in other words, when there is aversion felt towards a quality in a person, we may surmise that there is aversion towards that same quality within ourselves. There's a story I gave several months ago, but to kind of illustrate this, if we were to imagine that, I'm talking to a friend and I'm talking to my friend about our mutual friend, Janet, who is just always gossiping. And it's just so frustrating and so annoying how Janet is always gossiping. And all the while, I am gossiping about Janet, who's a gossiper. And it's a very, I think, condensed or simple illustration of how we often might feel this aversion or express this type of aversion towards other people, whatever the quality might be, while at the same time, we may carry that unconsciously and act it out in certain ways. So if that's maybe one seed that this aversion is springing forth from an aversion towards something in someone else that also may be present within me but simply hasn't been acknowledged, then the second seed might be the notion that if I put others down, I might prop myself up and therefore feel better about myself. And so, with this mindful investigation, this non-judgmental curiosity at some of these assumptions, if I notice that judging mind come up towards other people or situations, and I'm able to see or acknowledge, oh, I'm gossiping about Janet. I'm doing that too. Then there's this effect of not only perhaps uprooting that seed, but it also widens humility. And if we examine even the second seed of this idea of putting others down as a way to prop myself up and feel better about myself, if I examine that closely, I might see I actually don't really feel much better about myself because it literally generates an unpleasant feeling to experience aversion towards another person, towards a situation. And I mean, certainly, maybe one might feel a little bit bolstered. But that is then, right, just reinforcing a false sense of self, which is always going to carry a certain level of constriction. And it's quite fragile because one might need to continue reacting with aversion towards others in order to bolster up this false sense of self. And so, across any of these types of stories that evoke aversion, whether they be stories rooted in fear or stories rooted in anger or judgment, we might be able to see how the seeds of really any of these stories tend to converge around a common theme. And that common theme is vulnerability. When I notice how my fear of maybe challenges in the future is rooted in a fear of helplessness, I can see clearly this very human vulnerability, a vulnerable fear which probably we all share or we have experienced at some point or another. Or when I can see clearly how the aversion that comes up towards other people reflects how I might possess those same qualities too. It can reveal this very poignant insight that I also carry blemishes, and that's also just a part of being human. So, aversion really creates this armored shell around these very tender seeds. And while one of these antidotes to disarming the shell is this practice of mindful investigation, the main antidote is this practice of loving kindness. And this practice of loving kindness, or otherwise known in Pali as metta, is embedded in this core wish for yourself and others to be happy and well. It involves reciting a handful of mantras, such as, may you be happy, may you be healthy, may you be safe, and may you live with ease, which one would first extend to oneself. May I be happy, may I be healthy, so on and so forth. And then extend it to a loved one, and then to a neutral person, and finally someone that you might experience aversion towards. But overall, it is a practice, a simple reciting of these mantras that is the antidote to whenever aversion might arise towards oneself, towards a loved one, towards someone that you really don't like, or even just someone who's neutral. And what we find is the more that we practice metta, this genuine wish for oneself and others to be happy and well, the more these armored shells of aversion dissolve. And we're able to meet the tender, soft spots within the shells with the love that they deserve. Aversion has this effect of creating a sense of fragmentation, both within and outside of oneself. And this fragmenting may seem to serve a function of protection, but it only serves to deepen this illusion of separation. Either the attitude is it's me versus them, or internally it's judging, well, this is a good part of me and this is a bad part of me, and so I react with aversion to this. And so if aversion is this, or has this effect of fragmenting and separating, then loving kindness is like the balm that erodes that divide. I think it's important to even just make a note, a side note, when we consider emotions, maybe like anger or fear, and how they really are just these different expressions of aversion, that sometimes it's important to listen. Right, to an emotion like fear or anger, because those may be carrying important messages. If I'm, say, being treated very poorly by somebody and I'm feeling anger, then maybe the correct antidote is not necessarily to practice loving kindness in order to get that feeling away, and to simply maybe then ignore being treated poorly, because in this maybe example, the loving and kind thing to do would be most to protect myself. So I think that is an important disclaimer here, because fear or anger, when it does show up, may be carrying important messages, but then maybe comes this question of discerning. Am I reacting? Is this frustration or irritation or aversion coming up in a way that is sending an important message that I should heed for my protection and well-being, or the protection and well-being of others? Or is it simply just an expression of aversion, this general, I don't like this, this shouldn't be this way, things like that? So, loving kindness is this dissolver of the separating effect of aversion. And it is a practice that can be done really anytime, anywhere. We don't even necessarily have to sit on a cushion for it in our day-to-day. Maybe we're talking to somebody, maybe we're driving in the car, and we can simply quietly, internally, just repeat, may I be happy, may you be happy, may we be safe. And alongside, or maybe even woven into loving kindness, is this element of courage. Because fear and anger, this umbrella of aversion, tends to bring up a propensity to avoid. And the more that we maybe avoid, the more aversion can grow. And it creates this vicious cycle of aversion and avoidance. I'm sure maybe all of us can relate to being really nervous, let's say, to speak to your boss or like a colleague about something. And so then, right, there's maybe what feels safe and what feels like this temporary relief is to just hold off on having that conversation. But then we find that the anxiety is still there, and maybe it even grows, which then maybe furthers the propensity to hold off on having that conversation with your boss or colleague. Or maybe one is feeling really frustrated or irritated by something, and there's a propensity maybe to avoid further investigation. So, to become first and foremost mindful that one is maybe stuck in this cycle of avoidance and aversion, then becomes this ground from which we might choose this courageous step of confronting the thing that we're feeling this aversion towards. In one of Pema Chodron's books, I think it's When Things Fall Apart, she tells a story about a woman who was having nightmares. And she was in a lot of distress because in these nightmares, she's being chased by a monster. And they kept on happening. So what she did was Pema Chodron instructed her the next time that you have this dream to stop, turn around, and face this monster that's been chasing you. And when she did in this dream, this woman, she turned around and she saw that they weren't terrifying monsters at all. They were these two-dimensional cartoon characters. And I think that this is a really beautiful story that illustrates how it's often the propensity to move with the current of aversion that is maybe instructing us to resist or to avoid or to escape, that is what maybe makes it seem like the thing that we are avoiding is this big monster. But then sometimes we turn around like this woman did in the dream, and it's like, oh, they're just these two cartoon characters. So practicing this kind of courage to confront fears or sources of frustration or irritability is not by any means a promise of being easy, but to take any small step towards, instead of the habitual away, cultivates fearlessness and humility and love and a greater sense of wholeness. And it's in these places that scare us, where our main sources of aversion or fear or anger or judgment lie, that we end up finding this hidden gold buried underneath there. It is, or there's this fairy tale. I haven't read it in a very long time, but it's, I think, like the Frog Prince or something like that. And the protagonist in the story has to kiss a frog in order to break a witch's spell. which I'm sure, we could imagine that she probably did not want to do because this is a frog and she doesn't want to kiss a frog. But when she does, the frog transforms into this prince and they live happily ever after. And so this kiss the frog motif can be found in many stories across cultures, and it's not always a frog, but this motif symbolizes, I think, the core of this teaching of loving kindness and courage, which is that when we show loving kindness to the thing that we feel the most aversion towards, internally or externally, when we befriend instead of push away, it has this magical effect of transforming our fears or our most tender wounds into some of our greatest strengths or allies. Maybe it's not, a prince or a princess, but it is a newfound strength that one finds within themselves. Or it is maybe a wound that hadn't been tended to or really acknowledged for some time that actually carries the medicine that we've been needing. And so there is, I think, a lot to be said about just the effect and beauty that can arise from this practice of loving kindness, from really seeing how aversion is going to come up naturally, and it may show up differently for many of us, according to maybe what we may feel fear towards, or irritation or anger towards. But this idea that maybe what lies behind that shell of aversion is tenderness, vulnerability, perhaps a wound that does, in fact, need that loving kindness, that we may actually begin to heal some of the splits within ourselves or between ourselves and others, and we may feel as a result more whole, which I think is even alluding to this third poison, if we were to kind of circle back to that, which is delusion or ignorance, because the fact is that we are already whole to begin with. I mean, the whole world is whole to begin with. And it is this maybe seed of ignorance, but also aversion, this separating effect, this distancing effect that does create a further sense of separation and constriction within ourselves and others. And when we demonstrate loving kindness to ourself and these spots of aversion, and those divides begin to melt and dissolve. It's like, oh wow, there's so much more space here. And I'm actually more whole than I thought or I felt. So that concludes the talk for today. I want to thank you all so much for your presence. And I would love to hear any questions or thoughts or comments, reactions.
Sure, I have something, Allie.
Sure.
This is Steve. Thank you so much for the talk. One line that I appreciate that I sort of jotted down is that narratives of shoulds carry aversion with them, sort of naturally. Because sometimes I can think, well, I'm not being, I'm not in an aversion mode or a resentful mode, there's shoulds there, so there is something to look at if there's some shoulds. But anyway, that the gossip stuff to bolster ourselves, basically resentment, that's so easy. It's such an easy low-hanging fruit that I don't know, perhaps most people engage in. We've all engaged in it at one time or another. Like you said, when you're gossiping about the person that's gossiping, but it's like this low-hanging junk food that allows us to turn away, basically from our own shadow. That's my favorite mindfulness alarm, any form of resentment. Even when others are being unreasonable, perhaps. And so you've given me a little extra plug in there for shoulds to consider. So I've been investigating through talks like this how the antidote of many things is loving kindness, that balm that erodes the divide. I feel that makes sense. And as you sort of got to at the end there, I think it's not necessarily the full picture of it. Like it's the like when you were talking about facing your own fears, like the two-dimensional creature, like the facing your own shadow or facing your own fears, social fears, whatever it is part of that healing process. Like you said, when the person turns around and faces the person that's been chasing them, they realize it's not really all that horrific. And that's important because I don't feel like you can necessarily have a bunch of dragons and skeletons in the closets and shadows that are kind of that you've been willfully blind to and expect to go straight to love and kindness. You might need a little a shake up and a little repetition of facing those things. Walk towards something you've been avoiding. That seems to go hand in hand with the capacity to diminish resentment and treat others better, including yourself. It's very counterintuitive, like you said, kissing the frog. For my this is something personal for me, but in my case, I feel like once I practice loving kindness toward myself for not facing certain things and certain dragons in life, I began to face those after that. That was a big thing, quite a change, and allowed those repetitions of facing those things and recognizing resentment, first of all, when it comes up, and then perhaps being able to diffuse those sorts of things and seeing that as for me, I've said before in these groups for just sharing my personal experiments, I feel like resentment lights the way. Like you're in the cave and you look for the glimmering path of where to go in the cave. Resentment is where to go because there's always that's where the work is. So anyway, those are my thoughts. And thank you for the beautiful talk.
Thank you as well, even for the beautiful point that you made about how loving kindness sometimes really needs to be practiced with oneself first. And I think that that's huge because sometimes, right, it's not so much maybe that it's not so much about needing to just jump out and maybe confront whatever thing that we may be feeling resentment towards or fear towards. But maybe just a simple acknowledgement in a loving and kind way of this feels hard and I'm scared
Yeah.
or I'm irritated without having to even go further. That maybe just practicing that loving kindness first towards the present moment and what is arising without even taking any further steps, maybe that is the first maybe divide that, the loving kindness balm needs to dissolve a little bit before we take another step. And that's, I think, the most important first step. So I thank you so much for bringing that up.
Thank you.
Any other thoughts or feelings?
Latish here in the room.
Yes.
Just some thoughts. Again, a great talk as usual.
Thank you.
You're welcome. I was thinking that it takes some maturity to reach a level where you can start to self-reflect. Otherwise, we just jump into that's what who we are, and we jump into our reaction or aversion, and not even knowing. I think that's where meditation helps, is to let us have a gap between our reaction and what we are feeling. Meditation helps us be more in touch.
I completely agree. And I think that that's a really important point to make because meditation is instrumental in terms of training this ongoing noticing of what shows up, aversion or otherwise. And I think that, self-reflection is maybe more about just the fusion that we may have already with certain stories or with the version itself. Like there's I'm not sure of like the correct saying, but like how a fish doesn't know that it's in water or something like that because it's, just in water. It's all it knows. So when we're fused, right, with a particular attitude or story, maybe I am just feeling really irritated or frustrated about something. But I think that that's me, and that's just, how I'm supposed to be feeling or thinking. Then, of course, the thought may not even come up to like reflect or think more deeply, because that may be a capacity for mindfulness and that ability to take that step back and acknowledge like, oh, I'm not this story, but I notice that this type of story comes up again and again. So like, what is going on here? Because this doesn't feel good. And I think that is maybe where self-reflection can come in, or this mindful investigation. Specifically, when it's maybe something that comes up again and again, but maybe that precursor, even to get there, is first the identif or the ability to identify, like I'm not the story. And that's maybe the ground from which self-reflection can come up. But it can be hard. I mean, I know for myself, like I've known, right, that I'm annoyed about something or I'm scared, and I'm like, no, I don't want to reflect on this. I just want to be upset, which I mean, that's another story too. But resistance and aversion can show up in so many different ways. And meditation is really important to, I think, train us all in that direction. Yeah, Peter.
Your comments, I think, are very appropriate in that regard. And one of the things that occurs to me also is that we are hardwired as organisms to be alert to danger. And our ancestors who lived out in the wild had to be very alert to danger, even tribal danger. That you're not in my tribe, you're a threat. And a lot of what I experience as an aversion is not necessarily organized around a real threat, but around social identity, status, so forth and so on. To me, that's a lot of what we get upset about. And when I can cultivate that introspective awareness that you were talking about, which is countering the ignorance part, is to recognize, wait a minute, I'm getting all upset because this person dissed me, right? As if somehow or other, the way my body is responding is if this person's going to shoot me, what's really going on is they're just saying something. And I think that's a really valuable insight to have. For me, anyway, I'm th that the strength of attraction of that unpleasantness, that resistance kind of diminishes once I have a different perspective.
Yeah, and I think that's really alluding to, right, the value of uprooting those seeds, and how that repetitive practice, as you're mentioning, of maybe continuing to remind oneself, like, okay, my body is reacting with this level of maybe fear or threat, but this person is just talking. They're just saying stuff. And then we kind of recondition ourselves to uproot that seed. And Karen, I think you maybe wanted to, I saw your mic on mute. Did you want to say something or?
I was just gonna ask, very good presentation. Thank you so much. But I was wondering how, moving forward in meditation practice and developing a better understanding of the aggregates and the non-self, does that help over time to eliminate hindrances, maybe just specifically the one we talked about tonight, ill will and anger, and or does that tie in with hindrances in any way?
Yeah, so like your question being, does meditation help with alleviating the hindrances?
Right, and having a better understanding and cultivating non-self, which is difficult, has been a difficult thing for me to cultivate.
Yes.
Cultivating the non-self.
So absolutely, meditation is kind of paramount and instrumental, or even just the ongoing practice of mindfulness to notice hindrances, and aversion. This talk on aversion is one of the core hindrances, so absolutely. And even with this core principle of non-self and that being really a challenging one, it is perhaps this practice of investigating and really just noticing maybe even the bare bones of how aversion shows up in the body, right? Like there's tightness, contraction, a feeling of unpleasantness. And then there's typically the story that's tied or married to it, like, oh, I really don't like this thing that's happening, or I don't like this, you know, whatever it might be. So that story is the selfing part. The body response, the contraction, the heat, the tension, the unpleasantness, all of that are just components of our experience, which altogether don't make a permanent sense of self because these are sensations that kind of come and go. It's like pieces to a puzzle. And so, right, if you have a whole picture of a puzzle, you might think, oh wow, this is a whole puzzle. But then you see all of these individual pieces of the puzzle, and you're like, wait a minute, this can't be a full autonomous puzzle because it's comprised of all of these different pieces.
Right.
So, if that makes sense, and then even with the stories, right, we might see how even those stories change over time. They change according to our mood. Maybe, I don't know, I'm having like a good day, and some colleague of mine that I'm normally irritated by, I'm like, oh, you know, you're a pleasant person to be around. But that's because I'm in a pleasant state. So even that has the propensity to change. And I think even give some clue that there really isn't this stable, permanent sense of self. If even our reactions can change on a daily basis, or our beliefs can change. If that makes sense, there's so much that can be said about non-self. I am glad that you're bringing it up. Yeah.
I know. I appreciate that. Now it does. That putting the puzzles together, there's a lot of pieces. So
We have time for one more question from Robert.
It's not a question, it's more of an observation listening to your lovely talk and what other people are saying. And I don't know whether it's relevant, but I read a quote the other day. I think it was Pema Chodron, actually. And while the idea wasn't new to me, it was the wording, the way it was said. And the quote was that you are the sky, and the thoughts and the feelings is the weather. You know, weather comes and goes, and I think that's a good idea to keep in mind. And really, you have to get to the state where you're constantly aware of that, of this coming and going, is to practice that throughout the day.
Yeah, and then not be aversive to rain because that's part of the weather.
Yeah, or just realizing that you're
Yeah.
not the weather, the weather is the weather kind of
Yeah.
thing, and you're the sky. But I don't know whether that's.
It's quite
Well,
relevant. So thank you very much for your presentation, Allie. Well thought out and well articulated. So let's sit together as we are accustomed to doing. Thank you for your practice. I wish you well and hope that we're reasonably safe and happy until the next time we have a chance to chat.